Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the podcast. Today, we have another unbelievable guest in Jasper Tordoff. Now, Jasper Tordoff is an art broker and an art specialist. And recently, he was actually interviewed live on Sky News about Banksy's pretty brilliant artwork recently. I say pretty brilliant. Banksy is literally one of the most talented artists in the world. Now, in this conversation, we have a ton of fun talking about art, talking about the residual values, talking about the intricacies of art, and also luxury watches. Before we start this podcast, if you do me a huge favor and hit that subscribe button, like button, five-star button, whatever it is, wherever you are, I'd really appreciate it. It honestly helps so much more than you guys know. And the more likes and subscribes and all that social media stuff that we can get, the more incredible guests we can get on the podcast. This is the Into the Mind podcast. My name is Harrison Brown. If you're watching or listening, I hope this helps. For the Doohan podcast, for example, we posted like a short, I think it was me and him talking about our hairlines, and we were like, oh my God. And it got like, I think it got like millions of views. And then so many people from there came onto Spotify and, and watched it. So it's a great form of, of social.
No, it's really good. I mean, how did you, you're obviously a rugby fan, having Ali Price and Doohan van der Merwe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously Scottish as well. I can hear that.
It helps.
Yeah. It helps. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I knew the rugby boys from, we kind of bumped into Ali Price and Magaluf. This is a long time ago when I was
of all places.
And, and because we were Scottish and he was Scottish, we kind of clicked, and then we started hanging around with him, and then through that I kind of met, you know, Hamish Watson, John Barkley, one of the older Scotland players, Jim Hamilton, and all the rest of it. And then one thing led to another, but they all love their watches, I'll tell you that. They all love like luxury watches.
Really, do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. I was hearing about that on the podcast. It is interesting. I see, and that's obviously Chisholm Hunter.
Yeah.
So there we are. So I can imagine you guys were just sort of chatting quite heavily about watches and things like
that.
We
had to crop some of it out.
It's a good passion.
It's a brilliant passion, but it also, I suppose it comes back to that kind of art thing as well. Like these heirloom pieces that have been passed down through the generations, or like John Mayer is one that when he, God forbid, goes, his watches will be worth so much more. Just because he's, you know, he's no longer there. But you do find that these historical artifact pieces are just like, they infatuate everyone. They really do.
Yeah, what was this? Sylvester Stallone's, because I've got a little interest in watches. I think from the fact that they're very collectible, similar to sort of prints and editions. And obviously it's a market that's traded. It's a huge market really that's traded, and people collect them for passion and also investment. And there was some crazy sales happened recently. There was a Sylvester Stallone's Patek Philippe that was, I think, never opened. Then there was the Paul Newman Daytona.
Crazy.
Which I think that sold at one of the big auction houses. And it was like the Paul Newman Daytona, which is, I mean, that's once in a lifetime, the opportunity to buy something like that.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's nuts. It's nuts. The provenance it adds is crazy.
Yeah,
and but if you have the means and that's what you like, I mean, it's a bit of a no brainer. It's once in a lifetime opportunity. You're going to bid as much as you can possibly afford at that time.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And it's fun to watch,
and especially when you get. I'm not sure how it works with you guys, but do you get people coming from overseas a lot of the time to bid on some of these, you know, these incredible pieces that you sell, like in terms of art?
Yeah, it's so we're private sale. So that's probably the biggest distinction is just like auction, and we discussed, you know, Paul Newman, et cetera. We do distinctly private sale. So we get clients from all over the world. You know, obviously big markets for us would be Asia. Australia is becoming an increasingly bigger market for us, in America. And again, the UK for a lot of Banksy's, et cetera. But I mean, it's less them physically coming over because everything's kind of traded online now, which is, I guess, the beauty of what happened during the pandemic. Everything went online, and you could be in Asia bidding on an auction that's happening in Europe. But definitely, I think that's a wonderful thing. But yeah, we get collectors from all around the world, and it's also interesting to see what their taste preferences is. Typically in America, you'll have people that really like Warhol, stuff that's more related to their culture. But more recently, it's becoming, we've got clients in Asia looking to buy Warhol and not necessarily artists that they're sort of known for or from that part of the world. So it's a real spread. Mm. I imagine it's probably quite similar in the watch industry as well. Everything's so connected now, it's online.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is. Isn't it wild that people can spend, like, especially online? We found this over COVID from Chisholm Hunter's point of view, who are the sponsors of the podcast, but we found that people were buying like £20,000, £50,000, £75,000 watches without seeing them.
Yeah. We had and it's crazy to think, actually. I mean, if 5 years ago, I don't think that would have been the case. Mm. Particularly, you know, in the day and age, sadly, that we live in, with, you have to have an awful lot of confidence in a system, a service, a website, somebody you're dealing with in order to transact that unseen. Mm. And also in the product as well, you've got to feel that the company selling you this item has done their due diligence in making sure it's correct and the conditions as described. I think one of the big drivers for everything going online and confidence in purchasing things online was COVID, when people couldn't travel to go and see these things. And I think I mentioned earlier that all the auctions went online. And really, we've got some fantastic tools available to us in terms of, for the prints and multiples, the artworks that we sell. You can get a really good idea. We have everything condition reported by third parties, so high-res images. Mm-hmm. And we found people were, you know, spending upwards of, you know, £250,000 during COVID without seeing something. Mm. And, you know, it does take a really good service to give that service so that somebody feels comfortable. And, you know, often we'd come sort of recommended to these clients, and but it's quite a substantial amount of money to part with without, you know, physically seeing the artwork, meeting someone. But it's really, I think COVID and the fact that everything went online, people almost had to, in a way. Otherwise, you know, you probably wouldn't have the opportunity to buy these things.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it became content related as well, in terms of that. This is where, so I started as a videographer, so I was kind of in the right place at the right time when it came to COVID, because everyone needed videography, because it was so imperative to selling. You know, if you go online and you're buying a car and there's only one image that's a render of the car, you're not going to buy it, because you need to see, you know, everything. It needs to be all encompassing. Yeah. Do you guys do that? Yeah. So you have high res images. Do you also do like video tours and stuff when the client's looking? I suppose at a £250,000 piece, you'll get a walk around.
It is funny. I mean, we would probably give exactly the same service to somebody who is spending, you know, much less than that. It's a very standardized procedure that we have to follow. I think the big thing for us, particularly in the art industry, is a lot of new collectors and established collectors can fall into the trap of buying something framed. Mm. Now, that's usually when you find issues down the line with the artwork, whether it's been framed poorly, etc. What we do, which I think gives our clients, whether sort of new or existing, a huge amount of confidence, is that we have everything inspected out of the frame by a third party conservation specialist. So it's non-biased, and we share all of the details about the work's condition, the photographs that these guys can take. Ultimately, it's pieces of paper at the end of the day. Mm. So, you know, you can really photograph that. We also have the ability to send videos of artworks. And it's a completely non-biased system that's fair. It's fair to the client that's selling it, and also to the client that's interested in purchasing it. And that seems to be a really standardized procedure. Like I said at the beginning, it's difficult when you're buying something framed, particularly if you're spending a lot of money on something. That's when you fall into the issues of maybe previous bad framing, particularly if you bought a Banksy back in 2004 and you paid £50 for it, and you went to IKEA to get a cheap frame and glued it down or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's going to cause some damage to the print down the line. So I think that's what really gives clients confidence. It's sadly not an industry standard. We really think it should be. You want to see the front and the back just as much in our experience. But that's probably the biggest factor. I mean, we don't have a physical gallery space where we really occupy the online space. So we have to make sure that what we're showing clients through email or through WhatsApp is exactly what they will be receiving. So it's something we've really worked on as a company, and it, you know, so far it's going really well.
And so that's interesting. So would you recommend that, see, if I was looking at like a piece of art for my studio or whatever it is, would you recommend being more hesitant when it came to the framing element? Like if a brand or a company was trying to sell it with the frame, would you suggest maybe, you know, just being a bit more careful?
Sure. I think we're slightly a bit more pedantic about it, Harrison. I mean, if you were going to sort of a primary gallery and you saw something that was new, i.e. probably created that year by an artist, and as part of buying the artwork, they included a beautiful sort of bespoke frame and you enjoyed the frame, I wouldn't hesitate at that. Where it sort of becomes an issue is when you're buying works, older works, so Banksy's or Warhols that were produced in the 60s or 70s from factory editions. Because at the time that these were produced and purchased by clients, these were not as valuable as they are now. Mm. People treated them as, you know, picking up a poster for a few hundred quid, perhaps, certainly in the case of Banksy. And so these works, which are fragile bits of paper, could have then been framed really crudely.
Yeah.
For example, a lot of Banksy's were stuck on university students' walls and sort of pinholed and blue tacked to the fridge, because people just thought they were funny artworks. You know, no, Banksy didn't have the acclaim that he has now. And, you know, so naturally the prints were damaged. And in the market we're in, probably very similar to the watch market, condition is everything. If a work's in excellent condition, it's going to fetch more money than a work that's in poor condition.
Yeah.
So if you were to buy a Warhol that's been in its frame since the 70s, you know, I definitely would advise to have it unframed, check the back. Conservation framing didn't exist back then. So sometimes people would have framed these themselves. They would have used a framer that was slightly cheaper than a better option that they had available to them. And I've seen works and they've been unframed, glued down almost with sort of PVA glue.
Oh my God.
You're trying to, you know, chain, pick it up. And it will just cause you a headache when you get down the line and you know, you want to reframe it, you move house, the frame doesn't work with the current interior. Mm. So definitely with something, you know, slightly older, we'd always recommend. And you want to have total confidence in what you're buying. And the back sometimes is just as important as the front. And also in terms of authenticity as well, some Warhols are signed on the back. They've got publisher stamps on the back. So in terms of deciphering whether the work is in fact a genuine Warhol or by any artist, I mean, David Hockney's studio sometimes wrote bits on the back of these pieces. It's paramount to the authenticity to make sure you see the back, make sure the paper type's correct. Because you have to be very careful in this day and age with works that are pretending to be something that they're not. So yeah, to answer your question, prints and multiples from you know, a long time ago, I always would recommend having it, you know, having the back checked.
Can you imagine if you were a student back in the day and you stuck a poster on the wall that you thought was just a funny piece of art, and then you figure out in, you know, 10 years time that it's worth, you know, millions.
I know it's hindsight. We always say hindsight's the best dealer, and we have an awful lot of clients that, you know, for an example, the Banksy Girl with Balloon, which I think there might be an image you're familiar with. I think it was 2008, was voted the most iconic image in the UK. So when he released this, it was back in 2004, and he did an unsigned version, which was a printed edition of 600 works, all editions. And then he did a signed variation of 150 that he signed. And I think the price difference, and this is speaking to clients that Banksy would have these pop-up shops, and no one knew who Banksy was, and it was just sort of down in Bristol. And if you were there, you would go in and maybe pick one up. And I think the unsigned, they were being offered for £75, which I think back then was, you know, a sizable amount of money, but, you know, nothing as to compared to, you know, what you can go into a gallery in London and expect to pay for something. And the amount of clients that, you know, they then come to us and they've got the, you know, they picked up two unsigned variations and gave one to their friend. And they always sort of kicking themselves and saying, you know, if I picked up the signed version for an extra £150 or £100, whatever, and they couldn't afford it at the time. And the difference now in today's market is, you know, well over £150,000 in terms of what you can, you know, expect to receive. So they always sort of kicking themselves going, why didn't I sort of, you know, dig deeper into my pocket for something? But you just have to say, how many people walk past Santa's Ghetto, which is one of the pop-ups that Banksy was selling his works for. So, you know, the fact that you pick one up is great, but no one saw it coming. It's one of these amazing stories that no one saw happening. So still a great investment. I mean, I'm not sure, obviously, Harrison, in being involved in the watch market, whether there's any watches that have risen in value that much from initial release. I'd be quite intrigued.
Yeah. I think there definitely has. I think it's funny, the watch in the art industry is very, very kind of different. Well, they're quite similar in that way. I suppose the watch industry, you never see it coming. Like there's trends that you just never see. It's a bit like Banksy. Nobody saw that coming. And I have friends, I have friends and colleagues that I work with that, you know, back in the day, they could buy a Patek Philippe for £10,000. And now because that Patek Philippe discontinues, it's up at 70, 80, 90, 100,000 pounds. And it's wild. Wow. Or you get watch brands, and sometimes we saw this with Omega. We actually stock them. They released a version called the CK. I can't remember the numbers after that, but it was something called like the CK. And they didn't tell anyone about the release, but then within 6 months, they discontinued it. So it wasn't a limited edition, but because it was produced over COVID, there was very few numbers of it. So all of a sudden, like 2 years after this watch got discontinued, everyone wants that watch again. And it's like this bizarre thing that nobody can see those trends coming, and for like it's unforeseen circumstances. Yeah. And then also you get people that like collaborate with certain, you know, James Bond is a big one. Omega collaborate with James Bond. So people resonate with that, and they want those James Bond iterations, and they're limited. And the more limited they are, the more expensive they are. I think a brand that I've definitely seen huge uptake in, and I think it's just because of the limited numbers they produced. I think they produce about 30 to 40,000 watches a year worldwide, which is not a lot.
Wow. It's not very many.
Not very many, especially when you look at like Rolex, which is a fantastic brand. They release like 1.2 million watches a year. So when you compare, do you know what I mean? When you compare them, you're like
a fraction of it.
You know, rarity is extremely valuable. So I've seen Vacheron Constantin just take it like rocket, and the popularity and demand for them. Have you heard of the Holy Trinity?
I'm not familiar, not in a watch sense.
So the Holy Trinity is like, I'm such a watch nerd. You've opened a can of worms here.
No, I have an interest in it. Mm. You know, the collecting aspect, I find it fascinating. The whiskey as well. I'm interested in these markets.
Yeah. So the Holy Trinity is like Vacheron Constantin, Patek Philippe, and AP. So the watch enthusiasts call these brands the Holy Trinity of watches. They're the three brands that are the creme de la creme, the pinnacle of everything. And to have a brand like Vacheron that produces so few watches is definitely a attraction to people, especially business people that want to be a bit more understated. I feel like when you go down to London, you know, the crime around specifically Rolex and Patek is so high that they're very nervous about going for those watches now. So what you see is they say, you know, Vacheron is unbelievable quality, the oldest watch brand in continuous production. It's part of the Holy Trinity.
Yeah.
Let's go for that. And then hopefully your wrist won't get sort of ripped off.
I mean, it's a shame that people have to think about it, but it's very true. I mean, Rolex, you'd quite easily recognize a valuable Rolex. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think I've seen a couple of these Vacheron Constantins, the sort of slim dress watches.
Yeah.
That could easily get confused with something else. And you'd probably have to be a bit in the know to realize sort of whether it has any value to it. But I'm surprised Rolex isn't up there in the, perhaps they sell too many watches. Perhaps they're slightly too accessible to be in that Holy Trinity.
Yeah.
It sounds like supply and demand really sort of drives that market.
Exactly. It's supply and demand totally. I suppose it's like art, you know, if Banksy made too many paintings or, you know, Ferrari made too many cars, all of a sudden you see a dip. And I think that's what makes these special editions special. You know, Rolex had a period where they were using Zenith, that you've totally opened up a can of worms here, by the way. I'm such a nerd.
Like I said, Harrison, I'm interested in this as well.
So Rolex had a period that they were using Zenith's movements. So Zenith's another luxury watch brand, and Rolex were using these movements in their Daytona. And they changed that quite quickly. So as a result, there's quite a limited number of those Zenith Rolex Daytonas. So all of a sudden, everyone wants that one now because there's something slightly different. Or they want, you know, an Arabic numeral Rolex because it's a lot more rare than a non-Arabic numeral. But one thing I was going to ask you is, we, like, especially in the watch industry, have had major issues with like super clones and fakes, but like deep fakes that are really, really good. And I mean, I've been working in the watch industry for nine or 10 years now. And sometimes watches come to me and I can't tell if it's fake or not. That's how good it is. That's how convincing it is.
That's how good they're getting.
Do you have any issues with that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we do. And you can never be too careful. When we sell a work, we guarantee a work. So we're putting our sort of specialty knowledge, just as you would have in sort of deciphering whether a watch is genuine or not. So all of your experience, and we've got a very experienced team on our side that have come from, you know, background of auctions. We've seen all sorts of works that are sort of pretending to be works that they're not. There's a lot of things that you can do, particularly in the art game, to make sure. I mean, it's sort of basic, sort of crossing your T's. You've got a provenance is a huge thing.
Yeah.
So where's the work come from? Does the client have the original receipts? Because they're additioned pieces, you want the addition number to correlate to a certain sale. Mm-hmm. There's ledgers that you can go back to that are all online, whether it was bought from auction or bought from a, you know, reputable gallery. And then there's also checks that you can actually make to the actual artwork. So when we have the works taken to a paper conservator, you can check the blind stamp. So often publishers will have sort of a watermark that they stamp the paper with. We'll also be known to the paper types that the printmaker used, particularly at a certain time. They often changed papers throughout their sort of, you know, they had a working career of 40 years. They're going to chop and change and use different paper types. So we can physically inspect the artwork, and that's a sort of telltale sign. But there definitely has been works that, you know, on initial look, we've gone, okay, they seem okay. Mm. You know, that this is all fine. Let's get it deframed. Let's have some further inspections. And then, you know, thankfully we've done those checks. And the reason we do those checks is to, you know, then turn the artwork upside down. It doesn't have a blind stamp, or, you know, it's a very sort of good reproductive copy. One sort of good example is the Andy Warhol Marilyn. So one of the most desirable, you know, that would be the Holy Trinity, Warhol Marilyn, and maybe a Banksy Girl with Balloon. And I'll think of another work for the print market, Holy Trinity. But there was sort of a lot of reproductions done of this work. You can tell by looking at the signatures, what isn't right, looking at the edition numbers, etc. And then also we have specialist contacts that you know, worked with Warhol, that worked with Keith Haring and all of these artists, where we can lean on their knowledge. They have exceptional knowledge and sort of get their opinion on things as well. So we have to be 100% sure about any work before we take it to the market. And in the prints and multiples, a lot of works are actually fairly easily reproduced because they're printed, they're non-original. And some are quite basic. If you look at a lot of works by Warhol, they're quite basic works, particularly the early works that he produced. And so for anyone that's coming to looking to fake these pieces, it's quite an easy job. Mm. So yeah, we do all of our checks. One artist where it is much easier is Banksy. Obviously he's got Pest Control, which is his office that authenticates work. So that is owned by Banksy himself. Mm. And so for any work to sort of reach its full value, it needs to have a pest control certificate of authenticity, which you have to reach out to the office, send in details of the artwork. It's almost probably like a Rolex card. And so then once you get the authentication, you have a certificate, which is great. It's got a sort of die-faced Banksy tenor cut in half, and they keep the other half. So it's quite an old school way of doing it. But once you have that, there's no denying that that works, you know, an authentic piece. And if you're buying a Banksy that doesn't have that certificate, you know, the value is essentially zero. It's not an official work by Banksy. So it makes it a little bit easier working and operating in that market, because it's a yes, no question, as opposed to, okay, we've got to look more into the paper type, look more into the provenance. Does the provenance check out, etc. So Banksy's, I wish that was standard. It would be a great way. You know, historically you had Keith Haring that had a foundation that would be able to authenticate works, and Andy Warhol had a foundation that no longer operates. And so there was a way that you could reach out to the foundation and they would say, yeah, this is approved. So just like sort of watches, where you can go back to the maker of the watch and say, is this correct? So there's various things in place, but of course you have to be very careful. I know it's probably not as bad as the watches. You know, if you're getting a watch and you've got 9 years of experience and you're still sort of questioning it, it's amazing how good these fakes can be. Fortunately, you know, with the art market, it's usually quite obvious. And we can tell very quickly what is right and what's wrong.
Yeah. And is that with Banksy, is that because he wants to hide his identity still, that he goes through this, you're not going through him, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it's two things. I think I don't necessarily think it's to do with the identity element. I think when Banksy became sort of popular, so 2006, 2007, there was a sort of a bit of a peak in 2008, not like the peak we've just seen in COVID, and this is in Valley of Prints. And I think a lot of people were seizing the opportunity to create fake works. So a lot of fake works were circulating the market and conning quite a lot of new collectors and established collectors. And so the market got quite muddled. And so what Banksy decided to do is say, right, all of the works need to have a certificate going through me. And sort of I'll be the one that says yes and no. And also what that enables them to do is kind of control the market in a way. Typically when somebody gets a pest control certificate, that's usually because they're looking to then move it on, or at least have the option to sell it in the sort of free market. And so in a way, in terms of controlling the price, it enables him, because these certificates can take sort of upwards of years to receive.
Yeah.
And so if all of a sudden a lot of works were given pest control, naturally you would imagine that a lot more are going to be on the market. It might give the idea that the supply is really, really good. So I think it's a way that Banksy can be quite clever and control how many works sort of come to the market, and also have overview of where pieces have gone. I mean, back in the day, particularly for Banksy, I think it was working in the studio, there was probably a lot of drink involved and, you know, fun vibes, etc. So it wasn't, you know, like a commercial as people perhaps think it would be now, given the value of the work. So it's a nice way of being, oh, I did create that print, you know, this unique print or something, and for it to, it'd be interesting for him to see sort of works that he's done previously, etc. So it's all a big combination, but it makes our job much easier, I have to say. It really does.
Why do you think he's essentially in a roundabout way controlling the supply for the market so that his prints, well, we could perceive it that way, so that his prints, or sorry, his work kind of elevates. That's quite smart.
I think that's a tiny element, whether that's that he, you know, that would give you the power to do that, particularly if you're, you know, big, expensive original works, you give it pest control, it's likely maybe going to come up to auction or something. And then also, I think particularly Banksy, who gifted an awful lot of works, particularly if we're talking about, you know, original works on canvas, it's almost like when somebody gives you a gift and you ask whether you've got the receipts, because you might go and take it back. It's that scenario. You know, if Banksy gave you a one-off canvas that might fetch, you know, over £1 million in today's market, and you think, well, you know, haven't spoken to him in over 10 years, I might think of selling it. You would have to sort of reach out to his office.
Yeah.
So I think it's a control element, as just as much as, you know, making sure. I mean, actually, just as important. It's also making sure that people aren't being duped and can, you know, but by these fake works that were appearing earlier on in the market.
Chisholm Hunter are the sponsors of the Into the Mind podcast, and it's quite relevant that we talk about Chisholm Hunter, seeing as a lot of this conversation kind of revolves around watches and luxury and art, which is what I see watches and jewellery as. Chisholm Hunter are family-run jewellers that have been going for over 165 years. Yes, you heard me, 165 years. Now, if you're interested in luxury watches like Tag Heuer, Omega, Vacheron Constantin, IWC, Blancpain, Breguet, and many, many more, then Chisholm Hunter are the authorized retailer that you should go to. That's where I personally get all my luxury watches. I'm actually wearing an Omega Seamaster today, and I got it from Chisholm Hunter. So head to chisholmhunter.co.uk, that is chisholmhunter.co.uk, for your next luxury watch. And while you're there, use the discount code CHSUB, that is CHSUB, on the Chisholm Hunter website for an exclusive 10% off selected lines. And this is my thanks to you, and thank you, Chisholm Hunter, for sponsoring the podcast. Now let's get back to Jasper. I think with Banksy as well, it comes back to like marketing a lot of it. Like, I think that his marketing expertise in terms of like shredding up his work and understanding how the media works,
that's great.
Like, he definitely understands how to make a boom, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think the love is in the bin. I mean, that was a signed girl at Balloon that shredded. I think it was at Sotheby's. I mean, it was so an inside job. Everybody knew what was going on. To sort of fit the mechanics of that shredder into the frame. Awesome. I mean, awesome. I mean, that work, after it shredded, this is after somebody bought it, it then got reoffered and sold for just over £18 million,
oh my gosh,
which was the highest price paid. And that was for a shredded artwork. And again, that made that image so much more iconic. It was a signed girl with balloon. Yeah, exactly. In terms of creating a charade, creating things that people are going to talk about for forever, he is, you know, the absolute master of that. And we saw that recently with his London Zoo works that he's just done, and how the media got so invested. I mean, people were waiting for, you know, I think it was 11, 12 o'clock that he would come out on Instagram and say, yeah, that's another one. And people were like, fidgeting, waiting. It's he's an absolute master of the media, and I mean, he's really captured the whole nation and the world's attention, particularly for that you know, those few days when he was doing works down in London. It's amazing.
Yeah. And how has no one figured out, like, I suppose there's lots of people that know, but like, how is nobody in, like, you look at these social media sort of sleuths that they go through social media and find who people are and their true identities. We've all seen Catfish, right? So we all kind of know how that works.
Yeah.
How has nobody
exactly
figured out who exactly he is yet? Like, how has he kept that so secret?
I know in this day and age, I mean, there's been various sort of newspapers that have really tried quite hard to
figure it out.
You know, even with sort of phone hacking and things like that, that people can do. It's amazing. I think he's just got a very good team of people around him. And I think there's also an element of, do people really want to know? I mean, I think it's a real sort of like charm to him, the fact that, you know, he's got this, this mysterious sort of mask over him. And I think I don't think people would want to know. It sort of ruined the fun a little bit. So I really think there is that, because how difficult is it to be anonymous in this day and age, and also to be anonymous and be so famous at the same time? It's really quite cool. I think there is just people don't really want to know. Would it make a difference? This is something that I always think about, is, you know, suddenly if there was breaking news, Sky News or something, and Banksy sat in a chair with his identity revealed, I think it would be a shame. I think the fact that he's got this mask means that he can get away with saying things without people being prejudiced about maybe the way that he looks or, you know, his background, etc. So in terms of being a champion of free speech that comes from a non-biased perspective, I think that's very powerful as well in this day and age. But yeah, to answer your question, he's probably got a very good team and lays quite low. You know, financially, I think he's doing okay.
Just okay.
At the moment. So yeah, I think he's doing very, very well, given, you know, how his market has done. And also we pay a certain amount of royalties, so artist resale right on works that we sell. So in terms of passive income for an artist, European artist, it's really quite good. So, you know, we're doing all the work for him.
Yeah.
in a way.
How much do you think Banksy's worth?
Oh, you're asking the real hard hitter questions here, Harrison. I've had this conversation internally because it's just something that comes up. Naturally, you see a big Banksy sale and you think, wow, you know, he's getting a sort of certain percentage of that sale, as well as being an artist with his own sort of publisher when he was with Pictures and Walls, as an artist that was selling a lot of works very well. It's really difficult to put a figure on it. It's got to be perhaps north of 20. I don't know. I don't want to say a number because I might be completely off. If you look at other successful artists, you know, Damien Hirst is knocking on the doorstep of being worth $1 billion.
Oh my God.
But he's very commercially savvy. And I don't think Banksy's like that. Banksy does an awful lot for charity, an awful lot of, you know, not-for-profit work, you know, migration. He's a massive advocate for making that, you know, better for everyone. North of 20 million. There we go. Answered your question eventually. Maybe more. I don't know. What's 20 million these days? It's probably not a lot for a household name like Banksy. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I could be completely off there.
Well, I think it depends.
Maybe it's much harder.
I think, you know, with artists like Banksy that get into the limelight, nobody knows who he is, but they know Banksy, right? You know, some people could say that if he holds on to his work, it could be priceless.
Yeah.
Like at the point that he, if it were to come to him passing away from old age, hopefully just old age.
Yeah.
That's priceless. I mean, it's like a bit like there's only one of the original. So it's whatever the world wants to pay for it, it becomes. So, and you have these massive, you know, tycoon rich people that know of Banksy that if he were to unfortunately pass away, like we kind of know that the values would rocket. So in terms of actual money, it would, it'd probably be like 20, 30 million. But in terms of what he's actually worth, I think it'd be like up in the hundreds.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. Asset worth. I mean, I agree with you. Really difficult to put a number on that. You would imagine that he would have works that no one really knows about that are complete originals that have never been to the market. And again, just like what we looping back to the Daytona, the Paul Newman Daytona. If you have, let's say, Banksy's piece that's been in Banksy's possession that comes up to auction and it's a huge mural, original Girl with Balloon or something, you know, there are going to be people bidding absolutely millions for this piece, and it will be a sale like Paul Newman because it's got the provenance of being in the artist's studio or the artist's possession ever since. And so again, go back to opportunities. And there's probably an awful lot of works that Banksy has that we don't know about that haven't been sort of traded on the secondary market. It's a bit like sort of David Hockney. There's a lot of speculation that most of the works that, you know, David Hockney knows where they are. They're actually not, you know, there's an awful lot of museums and important private collections and in art funds, etc., and being sold all the time. But a lot of the most major seminal works might just be with David Hockney in his studio and that we don't really know about. So we just have to draw comparables, comparables to what has sold, what we imagine the artist has locked away somewhere. You know, and if any serious collector, if you can buy something directly from the artist's studio, you will pay a premium for it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a tough one. It's a tough one. I'd love to have a house tour. Yeah. Wouldn't that be so fun? I don't have to meet the guy, but, you know, just to walk around, it'd be very, lots and lots of fun.
That'd be phenomenal. I think, I just find it bizarre that no one, like, when he does these works, for example, the work at the zoo that he did recently, that nobody sees him doing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, how did he get away with doing that and nobody snaps a photo saying, I think this could be a Banksy work? You know, I just don't really understand how he, like,
yeah.
you know, fair enough when he was maybe less famous, but surely you have people on the lookout now that are like, there's a guy doing something on a wall and it looks very much like Banksy.
Yeah, exactly. Particularly in broad daylight. I think that Banksy creates the stencils and that a member of his sort of team go out and actually do the you know, the spray painting. The skill is really in the stencil. I mean, a lot of... And I do agree with you because where was the Three Monkeys in Shoreditch High Street? And I was just thinking that High Street, you know, on the bridge, I was like, that there's always people there, whether it's 4 a.m. or, you know, rush hour in the morning, midday, there's always people there.
Yeah.
And, you know, also I was so impressed by how they managed to get up there because it's, you know, you've got the bridge, you've got a train running across the top. So that was quite impressive. I think Banksy's skill as a graffiti artist, and this actually rubs graffiti artists up the wrong way because they argue that sort of hardcore graffiti is freehand. You do it there and then, you've got the risk of being caught. You know, it's illegal essentially. Well, it is illegal. Whereas Banksy, what he does is sort of creates these stencils in a studio, comes to a spot, and then it's very quick, it's very fast because he's already got the stencil made. And a lot of people say, well, that isn't actually graffiti. It's what is graffiti, what is street art? So I think with, you know, his fame right now, and also, you know, if you got caught, ultimately, you know, you're breaking the law. So, you know, the fact that he maybe gets other people to do it for him, you know, it's probably sensible because that would be a great news story.
Yeah.
Banksy caught.
You know, Banksy in jail.
And that's what graffiti artists, Banksy in jail, that would be brilliant. And that's what, you know, graffiti artists, part of it is that you're breaking the law. You've got to be fast. You're doing it all freehand. You're sort of thinking on the spot. You're looking over your shoulder. And, you know, Banksy's now sort of moved away from all of that and people sort of do a lot of the work for him. I think so. But that's, you know, a lot of successful artists are like that. You look at Damien Hirst. He's got a studio of helpers that produce the works. He signs the works for sure. And, you know, it's a trend that we see with a lot of artists that become successful. Andy Warhol did it back in the early, mid 60s with the Factory Editions. He had a large studio of people helping him. So it's natural. It's natural to have that. And it's also, it protects Banksy in a way that he should be protected from the law, and also to keep his identity unknown.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting how the media can switch so fast though? Like if he was caught prior to being famous, spray painting, you know, a wall when he used to do he used to be the one doing it, you know, he'd go to jail, but now he does it and the media all celebrates it.
Yeah, exactly. And to go back to my point, a lot of people that are breaking the law doing graffiti, they don't like that.
Yeah.
It's almost like he's sort of risen above the law in a way. In fact, that reminds me of a great print of his called I Fought the Law and I Won, which is a play on the famous song, but that kind of sums it up in a way. I think also to go back to his identity being not revealed, it's probably an awful lot to do with the fact that he's breaking the law every single time he does this.
Yeah.
You know, just because we all celebrate it and think it's great and he's one of the, you know, most famous artists in the world, doesn't mean that everybody else does. In the eyes of the law, it isn't legal. You know, which I find really interesting. But you know, back in the days, I'm sure he would have had a sort of a few close run-ins with the police. I think in terms of speaking to, actually, I was on a podcast with a graffiti artist who actually received a guy called Maddie, who's an active graffiti street artist, who received a print from Banksy after sort of falling for one of his stencils in the street, which was done by Banksy, which said "free spray area," i.e., you can spray here and you're not affected by the law. And then subsequently it was a joke done by Banksy, you know, and he was sort of arrested and charged. And Banksy found out and sent him a print, which we're now selling on his behalf. So it was a real sort of 360, but it's an amazing story. And I can't remember where I was going with this one, to be honest, Harrison. You know, it's ultimately, I think, I can't remember. I went completely uphill to on that story.
I do it all the time. Don't worry. I do it all the time.
I think it'll come back to me eventually.
At 3 a.m.
But it's and I'll be like, yeah, I'll call you up and be like, Harrison, I've got it. Yeah, it is really cool. I mean, I was talking about the circumstantial evidence. This was it. I think you need to be caught spray paint in hand. And because obviously all these graffiti artists have their own tags, their own names, which the police can sort of be like, okay, I've seen this tag name here and here. We can sort of locate this person. They're going out in the sort of the thick of night and, you know, CCTV, but you need to be caught. A lot of the evidence is circumstantial, so they can't actually prosecute you further. They can charge you, but they can't do anything. So I think that's also a huge bonus for these people. So you can have an awful lot of charges, but no prosecutions unless you get caught old school red-handed, you know, spray can still sort of wet by the wall, which is interesting.
I was researching, or I think it popped up in BBC News or something, some of these like really obscure methods of making art now. And I'm sure I read that someone was like, I'm trying to put this in a PC term and I can't think of how to do it, but they were essentially like peeing on a canvas and like,
right,
they were kind of like the different shades of pee, and they were trying to like do the right. art like based on that. Is there any like really obscure methods of making art that you've heard of or seen?
Marina Abramovic is one of them in terms of being a performance artist. She's done various weird shows over the last years where people sort of come to the gallery and she would be sort of hidden and pleasuring herself, and those noises would be, you know, heard all over the, you know, the exhibition space. And, you know, I'm interested in performance art, but I don't fully understand. It's not something that would resonate with me. I think it's interesting. You're pushing the boundaries out. I think that kind of performance art done in maybe the 80s, where, you know, everything was less free, I think that's interesting, looking at it in sort of contextually. I think in this day and age, in such a media, I think it can be such an attention grab and something that's literally just that. You know, to go back to the importance of like artists, et cetera, and look at those artists in a contextual way. You know, so for example, what Warhol was doing in the 60s and 70s was really groundbreaking, with sort of using commercially well-known images and screen printing them, and really beginning that sort of commercial element of creating artwork and then selling it, paved the way for all of these great artists, you know, Banksy, Damien Hirst, et cetera, they all followed. That's special because that's something that's really breaking, cutting edge and breaking. And now I think with an awful lot of performance art stuff that you see on TikTok, I think, you know, how crazy can we get before it's just so bizarre? You know, that stuff done in, you know, turn of the Second World War, that's interesting. You know, what else was going on there? What was this sort of mood like? What was people's perception of things like that? But, you know, people are sort of pushing the boat out an awful lot. We saw it with NFTs that didn't take too well to the market. But it's, yeah, Marina Abramovic, if anybody wants to go and see some interesting sort of performances, if you like, she's definitely got quite a few, you know, that she has done. But it's always, in my opinion, values found in the old school sort of artists that, you know, are household names, you know, that have done something cutting edge, and, you know, naturally their works have increased in value, and people want these kind of works. It's quite difficult to quantify or to at least sell something that's performative, you know, done by sort of a really sort of contemporary artist this day and age. Whereas you can buy a lot of the great works. And I think that's really nice. You can buy works that have been produced, that have been printed and signed by artists. Whereas a lot of this really ultra contemporary stuff, it's, you know, you'd be chucked on a waiting list. There'll be sort of minimal gallery representation. It's probably like getting a Rolex for the first time.
Yeah.
Or even getting one of the watches from the Holy Trinity. It's really difficult to access. You know, you probably have to be someone of note. And that's not really fun, in my opinion. What's fun is collecting works that are in a free market, in a market you can have control with, and in a market that's got sort of known value in a way, a known historic value. Just like with watches, I can imagine you can go back and see what pieces have sold at, and it's a comparable base market, which is just the same as the print market. So I think there's an awful lot of value in that. And from a collector's perspective, you can have a lot more assurance in what you're buying as well.
Yeah. Are you aware that there's a story that I wanted to, I don't know if this will be something that you know about, but there's, I've gone down a mad black hole researching this as well. There was a train in the Second World War, and when Hitler's empire was crumbling around him, apparently the story goes that he crammed a ton of priceless art and jewelry and whatever into this train, drove it into a mountain, then detonated the mountain so that it, you know, it was hidden. And there's been so many people
oh, wow.
that have tried to find it and locate it, and nobody can find it. But there's also records of all the art being in Germany, but no one can find them.
Wow. It's a proper treasure,
yeah.
A treasure hunt, a fun one as well.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine finding all that literally priceless art?
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, I mean, it's also great because a lot of that stuff, because, you know, Hitler was an insane art collector. Mm-hmm. I mean, collected, you know, by exceptionally bad means, but in terms of important works by very important artists that would be cherished by museum collections currently, there's so much of it. It would be interesting to see how that would be handled. So if you came across that sort of stash, would the reappropriation of works that were, you know, illegally stolen from, say, Jewish families, mm. etc. A lot of these are being returned to these families, and there's been some really interesting stories actually of, I think there was a very famous work by Gustav Klimt that's been recently sort of repatriated to a Jewish family that had the work for many, many years, and then it was sort of looted during the Second World War. And then subsequently, I think the family proved through sort of provenance and yeah. details and sort of statements, etc. And I think this went on for years and years. And eventually the artwork actually was returned to them, rightly so.
Yeah.
So I think that would happen to an awful lot of these works. You'd have an awful lot of families say, oh, I sort of recognize that picture that's yeah, probably looking a bit worse for wear after being partially destroyed. Yeah, exactly. Again, it's amazing what conservation specialists can do to these things to bring them back to their sort of former glory. Mm. But I think there'd be a lot of people putting their hands up. It'd be, you know, it'd be great. These works, it also brings up another topic of private individuals owning works that actually should be enjoyed by the masses.
Yeah.
You know, you look at something like the Salvator Mundi, which is the most expensive artwork to have ever been sold, which was done by Leonardo da Vinci. And that sold recently, I think it was in the last 3 years, sold for just over $450 million, which is what the buyer paid. And that was bought by a private individual. I believe it was a Saudi individual that's actually going to be put on display. But far too often, these great works get bought by private individuals that just go and sit in a free port in Switzerland, and, you know, they're in a vault and never get seen again. Yeah. So, you know, it'd be great if people found these works and they would get sort of hung up and celebrated and looked after by museums, or go back to the families that they rightfully belong to. I think it calls for a trip. That'd be a real, real fun trip to go. And I think there was a film made about people that were sort of trying to relocate artworks that were stolen during the sort of Nazi reign. But I think it's, you know, private individuals that have the means, whether illegally or legally, to acquire works. I don't necessarily think that they should be able to purchase these pieces. I certainly think that there's an element culturally, I mean, to heritage for certain countries. Gustav Klimt, the kits. I mean, is that is culturally so important to certain countries? And, you know, these should be on museum display that people can go and enjoy. You know, so that does bring up a bigger question as to should all of these works be able to be bought by private individuals where they have complete control as to who can view them. I don't think so, in my opinion.
Yeah, so you're of the opinion that you think that the artwork should be enjoyed by the masses, especially these, like Leonardo da Vinci, like these geniuses.
Yeah.
You think they should be enjoyed?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that Salvator Mundi that was bought, I believe, is actually going to be to go to a museum that's opening up in Saudi Arabia. And the idea was to, people only go to the Louvre to go and see the Mona Lisa. And the idea was, great, if we can have the Mona Lisa equivalent, mm-hmm. people are then going to come to my museum, which is great. You know, boost sort of people going to that part of the world. And that is awesome. You know, that's really cool to go and see something that actually has a value as well. So somebody has paid that much money for it, I think it's also really cool. I always think, because I'm particularly interested in the commercialization of art. So if you go to a museum and all the prices of or estimates, you know, if it were to come at auction, I think that'd be really interesting. But definitely, I think, you know, I don't want to be too far, like, you know, art for everyone. If you've got the means to buy something and you're a very passionate collector, I think a lot of these collectors would donate works to museums or to exhibitions. And, you know, as somebody that's interested in that, you can go and view them. But in certain cases where works are bought by, you know, fund managers, et cetera, that just go into a vault and then get sort of sold 20 years down the line for immense profit. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, particularly for originals. It's original works that are one-offs that a lot of people would be interested in. It's very different with prints because prints are an edition run, and that's completely fine. In fact, that's really encouraged. The wonderful thing about prints is that you can do that, and there's, you know, another 200 or 300 of them. And they're far more liquid in that way, and you can go and see prints and they're fairly accessible to go and see. But with the originals, I think it's a slightly bit more sensitive.
Yeah. Well, what were your thoughts on this? This is maybe slightly off topic, but I remember seeing a video, I think it was like 6 months ago, maybe a little bit less than that, of these climate activists pretty much, I think they smeared paint on the Mona Lisa or something like that. Or was it oil activists?
Yeah. Just stop oil in there. Yeah. All in orange. Yeah. I did see this. I think they hit quite a few sort of museums and galleries, smearing sort of paint, and I think they have these sort of fire extinguishers, don't they? I think it's a real shame. I mean, not to get into politics, etc. I mean, it's damaging something that, you know, once that's damaged, it's going to be quite difficult to reverse it. Fortunately, a lot of these museums have the best restorers, so works on paper and also works on canvas, so they can get those in almost like an A&E treatment and get the work sort of removed. It's interesting that they're choosing to damage culturally important works, you know, like the Mona Lisa. Kind of just goes to show that, you know, their line is to attack something that people hold quite dear to them. So Mona Lisa is probably quite a big part of
huge
identity for people.
Yeah.
People sort of, you know, so that's probably why they're attacking it. And also, it's quite easy. I mean, if you... You know, the security is great. You usually have sort of one person sat in the room, but, you know, you can get really close to these things. And, you know, you're right there in front of them. And if you wanted to, I mean, we've seen in the past sort of crazy people taking knives to works. There was a Gainsborough, actually, I think sort of 5 years ago, that was slashed by somebody, which is quite weird to get sort of offended by a Thomas Gainsborough picture, which is like an idyllic scene that was done, you know, a long, long time ago. So it is interesting. I just think it's quite easy for them, actually, to be able to go in there and actually do some damage. It's awful.
I was surprised that they could get that close. Like there wasn't like glass. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't fully protected, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I've been to the Mona Lisa a few times, always disappointed personally. There's far better works to go and see whilst you're over there. But there's, I mean, that the Mona Lisa is really well protected, with sort of, I think it's got sort of like a glass panel around it.
Right.
And then the actual picture's in a sort of plexi box. And then there'll also be glass over the front of it. So, you know, really difficult to get to. And it's the only work that's sort of protected like that. I personally think the panels, because so many people are seeing it, there's probably more of a crowd control element than, you know, everybody sort of getting up close to it and blocking everyone's view. But a lot of the other works, I mean, you know, that there's a small sign that says, please do not touch the artworks, but you can be, you know, right there in front
of
it.
You've got a kid as well.
Musée d'Orsay last.
You've got a kid. He's just.
Yeah. Just,
yeah,
exactly. I mean, you can imagine everyone say, right, don't touch this as you're walking in. You know, I was in the Musée d'Orsay last weekend, and they've got an incredible modern masters collection, so Degas, Van Gogh, Gauguin, etc. And you can be right there. And you're like, I'm trying to look at these things and see if there's sort of any glass in front or not. And I think that's a really nice thing. But obviously, it leaves you sort of a little bit exposed to these, you know, activists that want to sort of damage these works. You know, it's nice to get up front with pieces. Yeah. Obviously, working for an online business selling prints and multiples, it's not too often that we get with the artworks in hand. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we'll have viewings, etc., or, you know, we'll go to the conservation specialist to check out the condition of an artwork. And it is really nice to see that artist's signature or to see the, you know, the layered texture of a screen print, etc., which is often the medium that these artists have used to produce these prints. And that's really, it's great. There's something, it's a weird feeling when you first get up close to Banksy's signature on a print. And I remember it for a few years ago now being like, wow, this has been in his studio. And it's just the same with all the big artists, you know, David Hockney, etc. It's really cool to see that. It's quite visceral. And owning something like that, it's amazing. You can't do it with music. You can't do it with a lot of other sort of culturally important things. Mm-hmm. Whereas art, you can physically own something that's been in close contact or, you know, been signed by the artist. It's a really nice thing.
Yeah, it's something that I've been... So I do a lot of photography and I've got kind of various things going on at the moment. But one thing that I've always really wanted to do is start selling limited edition one of one prints that are signed from my travels around the world. And it's interesting. My dad was talking to me and I was showing him some of my prints that I've got around the studio. And he was like, you do realize if you sign one of these and have it one of one, essentially you can dictate the value because there's no others. Like it's just like, and I feel that's just a really like incredible thing when it comes to art. Like it's almost like everyone is individual. Like everyone is so different in so many different ways. It's the same with art and there's only one of them. And I think it's so like culturally relevant.
Yeah. I agree with you and it is interesting and your dad's absolutely right. You know, it's a lot of people say, well, art's worth what somebody's willing to pay for it. And that certainly is true in a market because we are in a market. If somebody's willing to exchange this amount that and somebody's willing to accept that, then that's a market. That's the price of something. What's interesting in the primary market, and this is a huge distinction to make to anyone that's interested in starting an art collection, would be the primary business model, which is artists being represented by a gallery directly from the studio. They've just produced some nice work. You walk past a gallery, you say, great, I like that. And they're asking, let's say £10,000. There's no record of that work being worth £10,000 other than maybe the gallery saying, we sold three earlier this week at £10,000. And, you know, there's a bit of private sale data. But in terms of offering that work on the open market, there's no evidence to suggest that that work will sell for, you know, £50 or sell for £100,000. And it's very unlikely it would sell for £100,000. But, you know, unless you've got a very good marketing set and the artist is sort of up and coming, you know, you can take a punt. Whereas with the prints and multiples, because they're additioned, and I imagine this is quite similar to watches, when there's a lot of watches of a certain model, certain year, or being offered at auction or whether they're being sold privately, is you can see directly other numbers from an edition or a series that have been sold previously. And that data can go back to, you know, 50 years, maybe less, 25 years or so. And essentially you can say, well, this artwork that I'm about to buy for this amount of money was recently bought for this amount of money. So this artwork that's being offered at £10,000, the last three times it's been sold at auction, it's made close to that. Obviously there's nuances with condition, et cetera, and whether which auction house it was sold at. Now that gives you some indication as to being in line with what the market's doing.
Yeah.
You can also track how the market performed. That for the prints and multiples only shows about sort of 30%. The remaining 60%, 65, probably 35 and 65, they get sold on the private market. So they get sold by brokers like ourselves, other dealers, etc., or they get exchanged sort of privately between collectors. And so there's also that data, which is hugely important. It doesn't always correlate to the auction data. Sometimes works can trade higher or sometimes they can trade slightly below. But I'd say that is the biggest distinction between sort of, you know, if you did create prints that were signed, definitely set the value. And, you know, if they are signed and one of one, that's unique. If you do end up sort of producing more, somebody's got something that's really nice. And also, if it does become a huge success and you get in early with something like that, you've got a nice example of the first ever one. Yeah. It's just like if you bought directly from Warhol Studio a unique print or an artist proof, for example, these all have, you know, slight sort of value increase. So that's sort of how it would work. And I think that's a really nice thing because anyone coming into the prints and multiples market looking to invest in artwork can see all of the data and do all of the research and have it all there in front of them, as opposed to going to a gallery where you know nothing about the artist, you know nothing about what people have paid for previously. You're taking a real punt. Don't get me wrong, that punt might pay off. There's a very slim chance of it paying off, but you could get really lucky and be buying the next Andy Warhol. But what a much safer and better way to do it is by buying actually artists that are hugely successful, that have had a huge trading history, huge value increases, buying them and waiting and beginning a collection and sort of waiting and seeing sort of, you know, what the value does.
Yeah.
It's a much safer way to approach it if that's something that it's a lot of our clients say to us, they're looking to begin a collection, where do we start? And we always say, start with the blue chip established artists and build from there. It's great. You might want some emerging talent, some, you know, new artists that people haven't heard of. Awesome. But I think in terms of having a diversified collection, it really wants to be made up of sort of blue chip artists that historically have held their value and historically have increased in value as well.
Can that be manipulated? Like, I'm just thinking if I were to start selling one of one prints and I were to transfer a friend 20 grand and then my friend were to buy the print for 20 grand and then I were to say the prints must be valued at 20 grand because someone's bought them for it. Is it manipulatable?
I think so. Yeah, that would be, you know, the argument using sort of my argument would be, well, you've got private sale data and that's completely manipulated. Private sale data in its very nature is private. You know, if you then took that work to Christie's and you could, and I think this is what Jeff Koons did actually, which was squeezing and manipulating the market. And also it's almost like what happened to the silver market. You can corner that market. If you buy enough of a certain commodity, you can corner the prices. Mm-hmm. And this has happened to the Warhol markets with the Mugrabi family, who actually owned so much original Warhol that they were able to drive up the price. And, you know, it has happened. If you were then to go to auction, Jeff Koons was very good at doing this. So whenever he had a big work coming to auction, what he would do is get people to say, right, bid on this, or I'm going to bid up to this certain amount. And then that work will sell for, you know, £250,000. And everyone's like, wow, look at that. That work must be worth an absolute fortune. Now that isn't, obviously there's a lot of mechanics that it isn't technically illegal, but you know, a lot of people propping up the market, which isn't right. That's not fair. That is something you could do that would perhaps work. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you were to say, well, privately, it's, you know, it's a huge trust thing. If that was to generally happen at auction, if there was somebody that said, wow, this is genius, you know, that would be a good start in fairness. But it does go back to you want a long history, because you can then be very sure. You want to see works that have sold in early 2000s for £10,000 that maybe are now selling for £150,000.
Yeah.
You want to see that really long growth. And to come out the hatch, you know, immediately at 10 grand or 50 grand, you know, fair play. But yeah, I mean, it's public sale data is very, very important, because you'd probably have a tough time convincing somebody to buy it if you're saying, well, you know, I had an offer of so-and-so. Because then it's just, you know, your word against someone else's, et cetera.
And how like... What is your thoughts on the photography print market? Like, I see there's a lot of my kind of friends and people I know, like Chris Burkhard, and there's multiple others that sell their prints for a lot of money. Do you see the photography market as being more buoyant and more considered as art, or do you still think it sways very much to the actual stencils and the actual drawings?
I think so. It's this is a very strong market for photography. I've collected some bits myself. I'm a massive fan of Nan Golding, and her works are sometimes signed on the back and from edition. So in a similar way, they're very much prints and editions. Yeah. Obviously, you can get the, you know, the originals, etc., and they're going to trade much higher than the printed editions. But they come up, it's quite a buoyant, flowing market. They come up all the time, similar, you know, different sizes from a different edition, different photograph from a different year. And that market seems to be going quite well. It's always a good indication of what a market's doing is when auction houses, particularly the big four, so Phillips, Bonhams, Christie's and Sotheby's, are hosting photograph-only sales. They have departments dedicated to photography. Mm. And it goes back to the supply and demand, which is just like the print market. Mm. There's only sort of 10 in the edition from, you know, it's a great photograph. It's an iconic photograph, you know, photograph of Marilyn Monroe, et cetera, maybe signed by her. That's really desirable. That's really collectible. And I think photographs are still very popular. You know, that's one trend we've seen is older works. So let's say 20th century works. We've seen that really tail off in the market. People aren't interested. People are going much more contemporary. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of contemporary photographs are still selling very well at auction. There's a huge demand. I mean, they're so collectible because they're editioned and, you know, people can see what they've previously sold for, etc. There seems to be having a lot of sales, actually, for photography sales at auction, which is always a good sign.
I think it also comes back to like historical relevance. Like, you see, there was a guy, I'm not sure if you saw the photo, but after the assassination attempt of Donald Trump, and there's a photo of Donald Trump with his hand in the air with blood running down his face, and there's an American flag in the background. Yes. Like, that has so much historical relevance. And obviously it's Donald Trump. Yep. He was the president. He's very famous. I think that would definitely be more successful than, let's say, like a landscape. And I'm not like, I am a landscape photographer, so like, I get it. But I think that has more relevance to people rather than just a landscape.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Because you can pin that down to a moment in time. Everyone's like, well, what were you doing when that, you know, assassination attempt happened? And yeah, it's that. I agree with you. That's, if you look at some of the most iconic photographs, they've always been involved with celebrities, events, as opposed to, don't get me wrong, there's some great like national photographers that do take lovely photographs of landscapes and things like that. But in terms of having iconic images, that is one.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think the photographer was actually interviews, and there was the timing of that particular, because I think before he had a shutter speed so quick on so quickly that you could actually see the bullet sort of come or passing through the air.
Wild.
Which is just nuts to be able to see that. So yeah, timing, everything was, you know, made, and that will become a really iconic image for many, many years. And again, it's like the image of Marilyn Monroe that was actually taken, you know, just before she dies. And that has become the most collectible, most iconic image that Warhol's ever produced. Mm. It's, you know, value-wise, it's one of the most expensive portfolios of prints that Warhol's done, just as much as The Girl with Balloon by Banks has become an iconic image. A lot of people coming into that sort of collecting space like to start with the absolute icons of whatever they're looking to buy. And it's probably the same with photography. Mm-hmm. Because that's perhaps what people have seen maybe at an exhibition. They've gone, wow, that's great. And then they've researched the photographer or the artist, and then they've figured, wow, that they've got, you know, huge body of work out there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to start a collection. That's a really nice way to do it. You know, with iconic images, usually we'd say, look, you need to probably build up to that. Typically a Marilyn's going to set you back anywhere from 150 to £300,000. Mm-hmm. Whereas with, and that's a print edition of 250, there was 10 in the portfolio that were done. So it's wild to think how much support the whole portfolio is worth. Whereas what's a really nice way, and what a lot of people don't realize, is that you can collect Warhols that are signed by Warhols for less than £10,000.
Yeah.
You can collect, you know, unsigned Banksy's for less than £10,000. And I think that's a really great way to start if you were putting money aside for, you know, the stock market or something. And you just moved house and you thought, actually, no, I want to buy a sort of asset that I can appreciate, that I can stick on the wall with, and that isn't going to cost me an absolute fortune. It's something I can afford currently. It's a really nice way to begin, to start, because then you take an interest in the artist. You might find another work that's a slightly better work in the artist's sort of career and want to upgrade. And then as it's an asset, the price is always changing. Markets are very cyclical. Mm-hmm. A lot of the art market right now is quite soft. It's more suited to buyers. And so there's definitely opportunity in upgrading collections. Prints are very liquid. You can then sort of swap things out. You could say, great, I'm going to sell that. Oh, I quite like this new artist, this new photographer. Mm-hmm. And so you can have an ever-changing collection. And I think that's really nice. But yeah, to go back to, I deviated there, Harrison, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
To go back to, you know, the iconic images, that's what draws an awful lot of people in. And I'm sure that photographer that took that photograph is quite happy with himself.
Listen, he's got something that image. I mean, I heard it on like a Joe Rogan podcast. They were talking about that image and they were crediting the photographer and all that kind of stuff just because the historical value that holds. I think there was a guy, do you know the photographer Terry O'Neill?
Terry O'Neill, I'm familiar. I've seen a couple of his works, yes. I know it used to be much more popular. A couple of our sort of collectors had works by him. Mm. But yes, familiar-ish.
So he was the photographer that did like David Bowie. You know, did you remember that photo of the Rockweiler jumping in the air and David Bowie sitting there looking like David Bowie? Have you seen that picture?
Yeah. I can't bring it up. Mm. I know a couple of the David Bowie really famous ones, whether they've been done by Terry O'Neill. Mm. I can quickly plug it in and have a look, actually.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting because before he died, he had cancer. It was really, really sad. But he actually came to a Chisholm Hunter event in Edinburgh. And I think because he knew he was nearing the end, I think he was like, you know what, fuck it. I'm just going to be open and tell them everything. And there was a Q&A. And a lot of the people that were in the Q&A were saying, listen, you know, what camera should I buy? What's the best lens to buy? And he was so like, it was unbelievable. He was so brutally honest that he was like, I don't really give a shit about the camera. It's about the location and the timing of the photo. And it comes back to that historical relevance piece. If you have like a £500 camera, but you get a photo of Donald Trump almost being shot, it's worth a lot more than whether you have, you know, a £6,000 camera and get, you know, something slightly different. And he was talking about the image of that dog, the Rottweiler that was jumping in the air. And he said, I'm going to be totally frank with you guys. David Bowie and I used to take a lot of, and basically what had happened is we were taking tons of, and I thought, why don't we give the dog some? And that's how they got that image.
No way.
Yeah. So they were just, really, really high. And they gave the dog, and all of a sudden the dog started freaking out and he thought, this is going to be a great photo.
Oh my Lord.
It's crazy.
So they were just messing around.
Yeah.
And it works.
And the stories that go into these pieces of art, like it's a lot like watches. There's a lot of, you know, really iconic stories around the moon watch, the first watch in the moon. And that's what people resonate with. That's what gives it historical accuracy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my phone tells the time, you know, I could look at the time right now, but why do I want to look at my watch? Yeah. But, you know, it's that historical kind of intimacy that it has that makes it worth money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's a one-off. Mm. It's, you know, in terms of the day and age we live in, if you're buying something that's particularly that a lot of these old watches have been beautifully handmade, something that as we go on with time, that's less, people care less about that. Everything's sort of digitally made now, digitally printed, particularly for the art scene, whereas something that's been handcrafted by somebody that's taken time and you've bought, there's huge amounts of value to that. And you know, that market might increase and you own something, you own an asset. And I think that's that's really wonderful. And you've definitely probably got the passion bug that I do for, you know, collecting prints and helping advise clients on collecting artwork and things, which is that you're always interested, you're always looking at other bits that watchmaker might be producing, or you know, other pieces that you might want to add to your collection, etc. So it's and it's nice, it's a great thing to be able to talk to people about, and it's something that you won't be able to buy in the future for the price you probably paid today, assuming all goes well, and you're buying correctly. And I think that brings the rarity and also the demand. If you've got something that somebody else wants, you're in a very strong position going forward. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a great idea to be buying things like this. They're great assets to be holding if you know what you're doing, or if you're informed or advised by somebody that knows what they're doing. And it's enjoyable. It's great. You have a nice artwork on your wall or a nice watch on your wrist that you can that you feel proud about. I think it's really, really important.
Yeah.
And it's a great investment, but there's a lot of traps. There's a lot of get rich schemes, particularly in the art market, particularly from galleries selling sort of primary artists, saying, buy this, you know, don't sell it for 2 years and we'll buy back from you. You know, these, you've got to be really careful with these. Best thing you can do, and it might be the same in the watch world, is buy the highest quality you can buy at the best price possible, and be well informed as to what the market's doing, what the market has done. And make sure you love it as well. That artwork that you buy might decrease in value and you might have to hang on to it for another sort of 2 years. So you've got to have, you know, you're going to have to look at it every day. It might be the same with watches.
Yeah, it totally is. And I've had so many people, we have, I'm talking about Chisholm Hunter again, but the YouTube channel on Chisholm Hunter is quite big now. So that's run by me, and there's, you know, I kind of preach, you know, I don't buy watches specifically for investments. I buy them because I like them, because I love them, and they're cool. And if they go up in value, fair enough.
It's the best way.
Yeah, like fair enough, they go up in value. But if you put all your eggs in that basket that I'm going to buy this, leave it in a safe, and then hopefully it goes up, you're not enjoying it. Like it's just why get into the passion in the first place? And I think that I also think that it's like a lot of it's about the community aspect. That an issue for people nowadays is what I call like first contact. So it's, you know, me saying, coming up to you and saying, Jasper, how are you? You know, that it's that first contact that people struggle with. But what I found really beneficial is if there's a common passion, whether it's watches, whether it's art, whether it's cars, whatever it might be, photography, it breaks the ice a lot more with people. So they can be like, oh, have you seen that painting? Yeah, that's actually a Banksy. Oh my God, I didn't. And then all of a sudden you get that dialogue and you get to know the people. Is the art community quite tight like that?
I think if you asked that sort of 10 years ago, it would be a little bit like you walk into a gallery, and we've all done it, where you walk into a gallery and to the Mayfair and you're like looking around and you've got somebody at the desk and
silent. It's like a library.
There's a lot of like, and you don't really know what you're looking at. The art's like really ultra contemporary and you're a bit like, ooh, what's going on? That can be quite scary, even for me. I mean, I'm still a bit like, oh, walking into galleries, you know. There's a lot of judging that goes on. I think as the art world's become much more open, and we've been sort of huge advocates of this, just being transparent and nice and welcoming, and deciphering all of the art world, because really there's been this sort of shroud of elitism that's been, you know, hovering over the art world, etc. But with the market like the prints and multiples, it's much more accessible, and the communities are great because you're own prints, you'll go to exhibitions of these artists, and you'll go to auctions of these artists. You'll have maybe some of these works that are being auctioned in your collection. You'll speak to other collectors, you'll speak to brokers like myself and other dealers and gallerists, etc. And there's a real sort of buzz because the artworks are, the collections are always very liquid. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a wonderful thing about prints and multiples. And so you can be having conversations 1 week about maybe letting one artwork go, and potentially eyeing up another piece. And so you're constantly in conversation, engaging around certain communities and certain artists. And I think that's a really nice thing, as opposed to sort of that, you know, maybe that sort of elitist sort of gallery element. that can happen when you go into an actual physical space. Mm-hmm. I think the fact it's online as well, we do all of our business online, more or less. We do sort of viewing with the clients. It's great. We can meet clients over the phone. And a lot of these clients, with the data that's and the information that's out there, are very, very well informed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we can have really great, detailed, deep conversations about certain prints and what the market's doing currently. So I think you unlock a whole new language, which and then naturally meet collectors at these events and things. And I think that's really nice for people, because just like you with watches, you can imagine it then sort of takes over your life.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of, you talk about it almost too much. And you know, your partner might be like, okay, look, can we ease it down a little bit? Which is the case with me. But yeah, it's a real hobby that turns into an addiction for a lot of collectors. It's passion that drives this. And we often say it's sort of passion investing. Passion comes first, but naturally when you're spending over £5,000, you've got to think, okay, is this money being well spent?
Yeah.
Which is great. I think it's really awesome for people. Hmm. And they enjoy it. It's probably very similar to watches. You sort of watch enthusiasts will talk with other watch enthusiasts, just like art enthusiasts would do.
Yeah. And a lot of the time the customers or the people that are actually investing in the art, they know more about it than you. Like I've found it so many times in the watch industry where I'll be talking to people,
yeah,
and I'll have like, I've been here for 9 years. Like I've got good knowledge, and
sure.
I review hundreds of watches, but then someone will come out and be like, oh, did you know that the movement in this cog is actually blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh my God, how did you know that? Like that's wild.
Yeah, I know. You have to be really careful. I mean, you know, as somebody that's a specialist, you've got to have that knowledge. But there's so much, there's a lot of niche knowledge, particularly if you're, imagine with watches with movements and mechanics, and they use this Zenith movement with a different this year. There's an awful lot to it. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of components to it. But just as much with prints, I mean, we've got clients that were involved with the publishing of certain prints. And so they've got really cool little stories about maybe works that were damaged or works that were never sold. And it's brilliant getting these trinkets of knowledge, mm-hmm. because all the time you're sort of growing your own personal knowledge. And so I think it's wonderful to have such passionate collectors that have, you know, just one phone call away. Mm-hmm. So you can go, oh, wow. You know, that happens to me every single day where I'm like, oh, I'm speaking to this, you know, wild collector that sort of rub shoulders with the artists, and you know, you learn so much, and it's so valuable because that stuff never going to be written, and it's stuff that's just going to get sort of passed on between enthusiasts, etc. Which is great. You know, every day I'm like, oh well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you have to almost concede and go, wow, you know, tell me a little bit more. So yeah, it's interesting. This you can't know all of it. I mean,
it's impossible,
because it was carnage back in the day. Mm. You know, it's carnage. The watches and these artworks that we're discussing were produced so long ago and produced in really bizarre circumstances. It's not like they would be, you know, correctly catalogued, or some works would get lost and they numbered the wrong. You know, so it's this, you almost had to be there to have a complete knowledge of it.
Mm. Did you know what you said? You said there's something quite interesting about sort of rubbing shoulders with these people that have also rubbed shoulders with the artist. Do you know anyone that's rubbed shoulders with Banksy?
I do. I mean, Banksy, as much as Banksy is sort of untouchable and does have this cloak of invisibility and no one knows his identity, there are sort of naturally collectors that will be able to sort of access the artist. I can't say too much, but yeah, when I sort of referenced that, it was really mainly to, you know, artists like Andy Warhol, who had a huge sort of presence, people like David Hockney, who's becoming increasingly difficult to sort of get directly in contact with, probably given his sort of age. But you know, people that sort of, you know, with Damien Hirst back in the sort of 90s, etc., collectors that have come to us, they've come to our sort of platform and have these amazing collections and great stories as well to tell. And it's important we know this as provenance to a piece. which is great. And you get these little trinkets of knowledge. But yeah, I mean, we've got some really interesting collectors on our database, and that are clients of ours that have got fun stories about these artists, because they're all a bit wacky in some way, you know, these artists. So
yeah, I think you need to be a little bit crazy to be a genius.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot. Stephen King, genius, who was, you know, drunken, alcoholic, and, you know, drug abuser. And again, Warhol, who, he was an absolute genius, who had his battles with his, you know, sexuality and who he was, and figuring out his identity, and almost was a victim of his own success in a way. You know, there's other people as well that have had that. I'm sure Banksy's had his ups and downs with sort of fame and success. It's not all plain sailing. And these people weren't sort of run-of-the-mill people. These were sort of creative geniuses that naturally have... How many other artists were trying to do what they were doing? Not very many. And how many actually sort of made it and constantly kept on reinventing the wheel? And, you know, and it calls on... Ultimately, there is an element of luck. And there's a lot of other artists that we feel are sort of slightly undervalued. But in terms of what the market's dictated, these people are the heroes of art history and of art collecting, and they will be for the future. Don't have a crystal ball. I can't say that for definite, but these people have been in sort of demand since the, you know, 2000s. So we would anticipate that is sort of how the trend would carry on.
Yeah. Well, you look at Vincent van Gogh. I mean, he probably the most, you know, genius artists out there. And was it, he cut off his own ear?
Yeah. And never sold, I think he sold one piece during his lifetime. It's a real sort of sad story. But I mean, the works that he was producing, when he was producing, if you look at sort of what was the canon of the time, what was generally sort of accepted, it is crazy, the colors. I mean, how he even sort of got access to that sort of color palette. And it was really out there stuff. It was very sort of bohemian and avant-garde, which it's only been sort of, in hindsight now, or, you know, a few 10 years to 20 years ago, been appreciated for what it was, was worth. But, you know, somebody that really struggled through life and that created some really wonderful things. And there is that sort of, that trope of an artist, isn't it? Sort of, you know, an artist is busy working away in their studio and, you know, there is that sort of stereotype, which is great. It's, they're giving their absolute all to the art that they're producing. One person that breaks the mold is probably Damien Hirst in his later life. He seems to have become just a commercial demon. He's releasing works all really like a factory now and signing them and just, you know, absolutely making a fortune whilst doing it. But, you know, somebody that's, you know, arguably, how much are you putting into it? Had his big break in the 2000s, has produced some really great works, but maybe sort of just absolutely making the most of the demand out there for his stuff. And, you know, the market that we have all created, which is that we want more and more and more by these great artists. So, it's really interesting looking at the personalities of these people.
Yeah. And it's sad to see that some of them, like, there was a gentleman in the watch industry called Gerald Genta, and he like the AP Royal Oak, that was his design. That was his concept. Yep. Like he made these iconic sports watches. But at that point, they were really weird and nobody really understood it. And it wasn't really until he was, you know, very old and unfortunately passed away that all of a sudden everyone thought, oh my God, that's genius, you know? And it's, these people, a lot of the time, that are really forward thinking and totally break the mold, they don't get appreciated sometimes until after they're gone.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you almost want to be the person that bought the whole collection or whatnot.
Back in the day.
Exactly. And that can be great. I mean, it's always goes back to buy what you love. Certainly people that were buying those Royal Oaks and I'd imagine the sort of the Mark I variation of that Royal Oak would be worth a fortune. I know sort of how that they're expensive watches as it is. And so people would have just, and what's really nice about this is you've got somebody who's crafting something that is a bit out there that he, you know, that he's doing for an absolute pure passion. You've got somebody that appreciates that and is buying it and wearing it on their wrist. And that's a real nice thing. Mm. It's the golden rule of buying anything or collecting anything is you've got to really like it first. I think so. If that's your goal, if your goal is to sort of make money, you can look at it much more analytically and look at market trends and data and really, you know, art funds are becoming quite big for the print and multiples space because they're very liquid.
Yeah.
You know, historically there was difficulties in buying original artworks, storing them away for a few years and then selling them. This comes with risk, whereas print and multiples, people are looking to build collections worth, you know, well over $1 million in multiples. Mm. So, you know, that if you're taking that approach, you can be far more cutthroat and almost look at the data first before you look at the artwork, which is an approach. But I definitely sort of, a really nice approach is being like, I really like that.
Yeah.
I don't mind what you're asking for it. I don't mind that no one else is wearing them, but I'm going to buy that one. And that's great. It's trailblazing. Mm. And naturally so, you'll be rewarded in the future or not, because you're not really bothered about that when you're buying it.
Yeah.
You'll just get a nice call up one day being like, that watch on your wrist is worth a fortune. And that would be maybe a nice call to have.
That Banksy print's worth 30 million.
Yeah, exactly. And then do you know what? You think when you go to clients and you say, you know, something that you paid £500 for back in the day is now worth, let's say, £100,000. Mm. You would naturally assume, okay, well, everybody's going to jump at that. That's great. But often clients will say, well, no, it's been on my living room wall and I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting because people get really attached to these things and they almost become part of their lives.
Mm.
And it becomes slightly more difficult to then bring these works to the market because people are saying no, unless they sort of have pressing circumstances where they might have to sell something to raise funds or whatnot. But it's a really interesting dynamic of how, and it's probably just like a watch is really intimate. It's much more intimate than artwork, really. It's on your wrist, it's connected to you. You know, that's a really nice thing about it.
Yeah. And it's sentimental as well, right? So it's like, you know, some of these pieces, you know, we got my brother, the family bought him a watch for his birthday, an IWC. It's a beautiful watch and it's engraved in the back of it.
Nice.
It's engraved in the back of
it. Love that. Yeah. It's a really nice brand.
Yeah.
They do the, what is it? The Aviator watches. Were they a pilot watch company? I'm going a bit wrong.
Yeah,
here.
No. They are. So they do the big pilot, which is their kind of, you know, pilot historical model. But they also have their new watch. I'll definitely look it up after. It's called the Engineer.
Yeah,
this thing is so sexy, and it was actually designed by Gerald Genta, who's the designer. Which is
Oh, wow. Oh, right. Okay. So he was the one who designed the AP Royal Oak sports watch.
Yeah. And the Engineer.
And now he's working. Is that how it works? Do these designers sort of go from brand to brand or do they sort of stick with?
Yeah, I think back in the day. So Gerald Genta passed away. I want to say it was about 10 years ago, maybe less than that. But when he was certainly a little bit younger, he went from AP, I think he was at Patek, he was at IWC and a couple of others, but it's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, they've got his sketches of the original, you know, what he wanted to create. And then they've got the finished article in the Engineer.
That's neat.
It's so cool. It's really neat. So nerdy, but so cool.
No, I think that's brilliant because design is really important. It's the same with, so Basquiat, when he died, sadly, when he was 27, one of the great sort of pop artists, and naturally he died, I think it was from an overdose, and his studio was still full of works. And essentially what the estate did is they then sort of found all of his works and started producing prints that obviously weren't signed by Basquiat as he was dead, but signed by the estate. So the work almost, they were like, let's create a legacy.
Yeah.
Let's show, you know, let's turn the studio upside down. And that's really special. Just like with that designer that you mentioned, with Gerard, there's still, you know, people digging through sort of design books and finding works that or designs that that need to be shown, and it's very common in, with artists as well for that to happen. And it's nice. It's a great legacy. It's a legacy of the designer and the artist.
Yeah, absolutely. I've just realized we're at an hour and 40 almost, so I'll have to, I don't want you to miss your next appointment. That flew in, right?
That's gone unbelievably quickly. Wow, time flies. I mean, it's been awesome speaking to you, Harrison.
Yeah, you too, mate. You too. Where can people find you?
So we've got quite a big online presence. So the company I work for is called My Art Broker. Mm-hmm. I think you'll know, as you listen, we're prints and multiples specialists. You can find me on the website there, or you can email me directly at jasper@myartbroker.com. But you can find me online quite easily, and get in touch if this is something that you know you're interested in at all.
Amazing. I'm sure they will be after speaking to you.
Yeah, hopefully so. It's great. I think it's a space that more people need to find out about, and just like watches and yourself, it's can become really addictive.
Yeah.
So watch out.
Amazing. Well, listen, thank you so much, mate. I do really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, brilliant, Harrison. Great speaking to you.